Everybody, welcome to another episode of MTG Rants. I'm Tanner Grace. I'm joined by Ross Merriam. Ross, can you be a little serious? We had the pre-show and you were just killing me and you're not serious. I need you at least like 50% serious for this episode.
I can give you... I can probably give you 36%.
See, 35 was my number, so hey, we're ahead. I was ready to negotiate.
But, okay, but well...
36.
Okay, 36 it is then. I screwed myself out of a percent.
Yeah. Because if you said like 25, I might have hit you with the 40, and then we might have met at like 23, 24, who knows. All right. Anyway, so in this episode, we'll obviously be talking about the banned and restricted announcement that happened. And then I think we're going to go ahead and continue our flashback series after that. So have a little bit of a discussion here, but... Yeah.
It wasn't a huge ban announcement, so yeah. we'll have some brief remarks on here to start, yeah. and then we'll get into some more juicy history of our time with Magic.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and tell the people at home what happened?
So, very, very importantly, the Utah Jazz signed Kenneth Lofton Jr.
Sure.
To an non-guaranteed multi-year contract.
Is this that 64% or whatever? I forgot the number already, whatever.
They also signed Darius Bazley. To all a non-guaranteed multi-year contract.
If we're going
to
talk about sports, we're talking about how Yankees fans are all losing their minds right now.
No, anyway. We don't need to get into it. They made some minor roster moves near the end of the season to get a look at some guys for cheap. They released some other people to make room for them. Otto Porter retired. The Utah Jazz are a hot mess. Watching the game last night was almost torturous. I'm just like, God damn, we suck. We're so bad. So bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as fun. Last year, they were bad at the end of the year, but it was still fun. This year's team, it's different. Maybe it's just like the second year in a row. I can't take it, but I don't want to get into that. Okay, Monday, against our expectations, right? We thought that the BNR announcement was going to affect Pioneer, but instead they decided to hit Modern, which we weren't really expecting, and ban Violent Outburst. Now, you know, obviously there are several other Cascade cards still remaining, Shardless Agent Chief among them, and then there's the old, two of the older ones, Ardent Plea and Demonic Dread. So the idea was Watsi said in their justification, we wanted to take the Cascade decks down to peg. They'd been too powerful, but we didn't want to completely eliminate them from the format. And Violent Outburst, being the only instant speed 3-mana Cascade spell, gives those decks a different angle, especially in combination with Force of Negation. When you can pick the fight on your opponent's turn, use Force of Negation to protect your own spell and force it through, it's a whole different can of worms. Because Force of Negation was specifically designed to not be used in that context. They wanted Force of Negation to be a sort of fixed force will, and that is a purely defensive spell to stop the nonsense, unfair stuff from going on, not to force that nonsense to going through. So, based on their rationale, I think it makes a lot of sense. And, I think it will have mostly the impact that they are looking for, the Cascade deck should manage to survive. I know there's a lot of speculation about Living End being completely dead as a result of it. I think that might be going a little too far, but these things also tend to be like self-fulfilling prophecies. If everybody says Living End is dead, it probably will be dead.
What is dead may never die.
Yeah. but the Rhinos deck should stick around. Ardent Plea, perfectly castable, especially in the new Leyline builds. You can bounce it with your own Teferis, which is kind of messed up.
I've actually seen some people posting lists on Twitter, and they've been getting, retweeted with LOL of, like, people FIVO-ing leagues immediately with, like, the new version of Rhinos. And one thing that
this shouldn't surprise anyone, right? Like, this was the goal. Like, we think of bans,
it's not supposed to kill a deck.
Yeah, but we're still in that mindset that, like, if a ban is necessary, it's because the deck is really bad and it needs to be completely killed. We're at a very different era of how bans work, and we know that what the stated goal was. So it shouldn't be surprising that people are still having success with Rhinos immediately after the ban.
Yeah, like, agreed.
That should not be surprising.
Yeah, agreed. One point people were noticing is that it's funny that it also hits Living End, and if Living End is dead, that was like the deck to beat Rhinos. That was like one of the decks that was giving Rhinos a run for its money. So now you hurt Rhinos, but you killed its prey. Kind of thing. It's Predator. That's what I meant.
Yeah. And those kind of secondary effects are very important. When I first played Elves in Legacy, it was during the Mental Misstep era, and Elves was incredibly good then, because what Mental Misstep did was push out all the combo decks. And even with Mental Misstep, you were still good against the fair decks. So You know, that could definitely have an impact and make rhinos even better. That would be unfortunate. I would say that losing Violent Outburst, even for rhinos, the main weakness it engenders in the deck is making you even worse against counterspells, right? The biggest thing that, you know, with Violent Outburst, yeah, you know, not only being able to win the counter war with Force and Negation, but just picking a fight on your opponent's turn.
Yeah, you can't end of turn, do this, main phase, yeah, do another one.
Making them use their mana awkwardly, and then, you know, untapping and resolving the real threat you were trying to force through, whether that's, you know, second Cascade spell into Crashing Footfalls or something even worse. You know, to me, counter spells get better from the ban of Violent Outburst. So maybe a deck like, is it Murktide, as much as I don't like it, gets a little bit better. You know, Azorius Control could get a little bit better, and similar strategies. So that's where I would look, is what blue decks can be better as a result of this. But really, like, you know, we're going to get MH3 in like 2 months. So I'm not putting too much thought into exactly how the modern metagame is going to shape out, because by the time it actually settles, the dust settles from this, like, we're going to have 50 new cards and the format will probably be completely changed.
You probably shouldn't be like rushing out to buy a full new deck right now. You should probably wait on that just a little bit of what's going to happen. So, yeah, I agree with everything you said. Something happened at Vintage. We don't really talk about Vintage on the show. So, you know, they freed our boy Ponder. You know, I'm sure it's Vintage. I'm sure if somebody out here listens, likes Vintage, sorry, we don't have educated opinions on that format. Yeah. So.
People have played Preordains that format. You can play some Ponders if you want now. Vintage decks play like fewer lands. I don't even know if you have enough fetch lands to like want to play Ponder over Preordain. I don't know exactly what mana bases look like these days, but
It was like
Ponder
me,
got
like
unbanned. Cool.
Yeah, it was like me talking about that when I played a lot of Legacy, when I used to have like one or two Preordains in my deck, and you talked about this. Like, I was like, yeah, later in the game, I actually want Preordain over Ponder because it's a better selection spell. Instead of seeing a bunch of stuff at once. Because, like, if I want one of the cards from Ponder, I can't do that.
Yeah.
You know?
I used to play Preordain over Ponder in decks that, if my fetch lane count was a little lower, people thought I was fucking nuts. I don't, like, everyone gets on their, you know, soapbox about Ponder seeing an extra card because of the shuffle option. And
it does,
I agree,
see a lot of extra cards, yeah.
That is a benefit to Ponder. But there's a benefit to Preordain when you look at one card you want and one card you don't want, and you don't need a shuffle effect in order to set your draws the way that you want them to. So when you're consistently not having that shuffle effect, that variable becomes a bigger part of the equation, and you have to weigh them against each other. So, the difference between Ponder and Preordain is pretty small. You know, I don't know. I doubt people in Vintage will want to play 8 cantrips, like maybe some combo decks. I don't really know, but I guess it's just nice to know that they like look at those formats for people that play them. I'm a little surprised nothing happened in Pioneer, but I guess they feel like it's okay for now, even though Phoenix is like half of every tournament at this point.
Sure.
Even Sam Party, the top 8 with the PT with the Vampires, like, yeah, it's a mistake to not play Phoenix right now. And I think we've all pretty much figured it out. Like, I was wrong when I said a second cantrip would make Treasure Cruise too good for Pioneer, but apparently I wasn't wrong by that much, because 3 was the number.
You were only degrees of wrong. Not actually.
I was
wrong.
Only off by 1.
Yeah, you're only some degrees of wrong, like 36% wrong.
I was minimally wrong. It was the least amount of wrong I could have been. You know, I was only off by 1. I could have been off. I could have been completely wrong, where Treasure Cruise was never too good for Pioneer.
It could have taken
5 or 6 cantrips. But
is wrongness a zero sum, though? Like, are you either wrong or not?
No, there are degrees of wrong.
I'm joking. I'm just kind of playing into this. Yeah. All right, enough of this. Let's let's head on back into the flashback streets. I believe we were just finishing up talking about, we had talked about Lauren, Morningtide, Shadowmoor, Eventide, and a lot of the Shards of Alara block, where you and I said that we both kind of started to move away from Magic a little bit, and that kind of continued into the Zendikar, Worldwake, Rise of Eldrazi block, which this was a hell of a block for us to miss, Ross. There was Eldrazi Winter went on during this, I believe, if I remember right. Was it during this set? Was it
that
it took over the Bird Tour?
That's much later.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. I get this wrong. This was Jace the Mind Sculptor era with Bloodbraid Elf.
Yeah, this is Bloodbraid Jund, and then the blue-white deck with Gideon and Jace. I did play a little bit of this standard environment.
Sure.
So I graduated college in May of 2010. So this is right about when Rise was released. So I played a lot of Rise Limited that summer when I was home, but a ton of Rise Limited. It's one of my favorite formats of all time. If you can get your hands in a box and play it, it's super fun. And there's a lot of sort of niche archetypes in that format, which I really enjoy. So the base of the format is basically the aggro deck is blue white, which is kind of weird. It's blue white levelers.
Oh yeah, I remember this. Okay,
yeah, where the it's like Venerated Teacher, I think, Tuna Blue 2/2, and when it ETBs, you could put up to two time counters on two target creatures. So you get to like, which is like eight mana of stuff. Maybe it's one time counter. I'm not sure, but it levels up multiple things. And that was your best common. But mainly you were the aggro deck of the format. Then the Jund side of it, there's kind of a divide between Azorius and Jund, which kind of mirrored the way Standard worked at the time. But the various flavors of Jund, and they didn't have to be specifically three colors. They could be, green-red or green-black, maybe splashing the other one, or black-red. And they were sort of rampy and tokeny, because everything made Eldrazi Scion tokens, which could be used to ramp, or you could pump them in various ways. So the Rakdos part of Jund was more token oriented, so that you could be black red tokens, and then there was like the if you were green, you were probably ramping. And you ramped into big Eldrazi. I once drafted like a green white ramp deck that was really fun because I had three copies of Overgrown Battlement, and then I had two Wall of Omens, and I played two of like the 0/3 wall for one and a white that pumped your toughness of your other walls just to get more walls in my deck for the battlements and like play defense. And I had like a Kozilek that I had drafted, and then Aulis Dust. My deck was really cool. So Rise was super fun. But the niche decks, there was the Aura Gnarlid, basically the Aura's deck, play cheap creatures and slap a bunch of Auras on them because there were the Umbras in that set. There was
I believe the technical term for that is Pants.
Yes, yeah. So there was the Aura Gnarlid Pants deck. There was Is It Kiln Fiend. There was a Grixis Control deck that played there was a rebound spell that rebought an instant or sorcery. Mm-hmm. So if, like, for three and a red, you rebuy an instant or sorcery from your graveyard and then had rebound. And that was one of your main like sources of card advantage and way of tying up the late game. You just like rebought your powerful spells and you just found some way to win. That was a cool one. There were a lot of cool. I like formats with like weird niche decks that you don't see all that often. When they come together, they're really fun. So Rise was great. But that summer is when I started sort of getting back into things. And that's when, because I wasn't doing anything else, I started taking Magic more seriously. And by which I really meant just like traveling more and playing more tournaments. And when Scars was released, which was that fall, I actually like was grinding PTQs really heavily for like the first time. Because up until now, I had gone to, like two or three PTQs a season that were really close I found out about them, but I wasn't like checking the schedule, making a fucking calendar. I mean, like, I'm going to go to 10 different, events. We were just playing tournaments. I used to play like, local vintage events and just go to those instead of PTQs or whatever. But here I was like, nah, I'm going to play a bunch of PTQs. I'm going to be good at this format. And I was very good at Scars of Mirrored and Sealed. It wasn't that difficult of a format. You almost all your sealed pools were built red white because it was hard to get it. There was a divide between like red white artifact stuff, which sometimes had blue if your blue was good, but base red white and then black green infect in triple Scars, and most sealed pools just weren't deep enough to be an infect deck, so you were mainly staying in the Jeskai colors, of which red and white were the best ones. I remember one of the early PTQs in that format. I this was back in the days where you like opened and registered a sealed pool and then passed it. They would be like, okay, pass like, three times to your right and then pass across, and then you like got that sealed pool. And I was opening and registering my pool, and it was completely bonkers. Like, it was just like 12 good removal spells, 3 bombs, like all in the same colors.
Just exactly what you want.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I was just registering like, Jesus Christ. Yeah. And so I was just curious like who was going to get it. I was watching the pass, and we did the thing where you like pass between multiple tables. Anybody that was around this time knows what I'm talking about. And it ended up in one of my friend's seats, my friend Mark Blesso.
And I, thank God.
Yeah. And when I saw when we stopped, I just turned. I was like, Mark. And he looks at me. I was like, you're welcome. He comes up to me after the build and was like, holy crap.
Give him the wink, you know? Like,
yeah. He easily top eighted that PTQ. So more importantly, I was doing okay, but I wasn't breaking through into top eights in the PTQs I played. I probably played a handful of them. It was just like X2 in the bunch. And then we'd make the decision 1 week to go all the way down to Maryland to Dream Wizards.
I don't think DreamHack existed yet.
Yeah. Dream is Dream Wizards that used to host PTQs in that like Baltimore, DC area. They were hosting their normal PTQ for the season, but none of us had ever driven that far. And when I say that far, I mean this was like 4.5 hours, which for us was way too far to go for a PTQ. If you were in the Midwest, it was like your average length.
If you're where I am, that's a joke. If we're going to drive for them, 4 hours is like the shortest.
We used to get like 8 or 10 a season all within 3 hours. Because you got your one in Connecticut, you got two in Boston, you got one or two in Providence, you had one in Vermont, you had two in New York, you had two in Philadelphia, you had two in New Jersey, and Philly is like 3.5. So and the Vermont one is like 4. There would be one in Maine that was like 4.5 or 5 hours. New England was great for PTQ. But we make the decision to go to the Dream Wizards one because we're all like feeling good about how well we know the format. But we're too poor to get a hotel room the night before. And so I wake up at like 4 a.m. and go, and we drive down in the morning of, get there like 9:00, register. I am dead tired. But I start opening my seal. I start looking through my seal pool after we do the whole registration thing, and I'm the person that gets the busted seal pool. My seal pool was a triple Sunspear Shikari, which was a 1 and a white 2/2. But if it was equipped, it had, I believe, first strike and lifelink. It was 2 keyword abilities, one of which was lifelink. Just white grizzly bear. If it's equipped, gets first strike and lifelink. Good of a card. But my pool had 5 playable equipment in it.
Yeah, so it just turned them all into like...
Yeah.
Very
one of which was
creatures.
The good rare equipment. It was Stratoscythe, 3 mana. When it ETBs, you search your library for a basic land and exile it, and it's like imprint. It's like imprinted to the card, and it equips for 3, and the creature gets +X/+X, where X is the number of basic lands that type. So it'd usually be like +3/+3 or +4/+4. Obviously, it's keeps scaling later in the game. So there was that one. I can't remember the other equipment I had, but I had 5 playable equipment, and I also had the rare equipment payoff card, Kemba Ka Regent.
Is that the one white for a 3/4 or whatever?
For a 2/4. And at the beginning of your upkeep, for each equipment attached to it, you make a 2/2 cat token.
Mm-hmm.
So just one equipment was good enough. If you ever got multiple on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I had a good rare equipment with synergy, with good synergy. I had that rare. I had good white removal, good other cards. I had like the disenchant that was important in that format, revoke existence. I had an arrest, which was the best white common removal spell. And then, and with all the artifacts, like I could almost have filled out like a mono white deck. If I wanted to, I could have been mono white. But I started looking through the other colors. I'm like, what other colors can I play with like 4 slots or whatever? And it turns out I had the best black common, the best black uncommon, and the 2 best black rares also in my pool, which was Grasp of Darkness, good removal spell. Skin Render.
I remember all these.
Remember that one, yeah. 2 black, 3/3, ETB, put 3-1/-1 counters on a creature. Just like, the FDK of the format.
Yeah, the Necrozol. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I had Carnifex Demon. 4 black for a 6/6 flyer. When ETB is, it has 2-1/-1 counters on it. Or, it enters with them. And you can pay black and remove one of its counters to put a -1/-1 counter on all other creatures. And this is a set with Proliferate. So that card was very good. And then there was Skitherix, which was 3 black for a 4/4. Did it start with flying or did it start with haste? It was like the big dragon of the format.
Yeah, and you pay 1 black to give it, I think it's give it 1 black, give it haste.
Yeah, so it has flying, you pay 1 black to give it haste, And you pay two black to give it, like, infect until end of turn. So, you, like, it could just kill them really quickly.
Yeah, it was. I remember them talking about it might have been the best. It might be the one of the best rares in the set for limited.
Oh, it probably wasn't even in, like, the top five. There were so many busted rares in the set.
Yeah.
Like, I'm saying, I just remember there was Wormcoil Engine. There was, there was, basically, if your opponent started tapping six mana, they were Plague Winding you. Because every color somehow had a Plague Wind. It was either, you know, the Angel, Sunblast Angel that destroyed all tapped creatures when ETB'd.
Sure.
So, like, your opponent would attack you with all their stuff, and you're like, okay, take it, untap, play this 4/5 Angel, destroy all your stuff before
I
attack.
This,
and you're dead. The, the red had Hordesmelter Dragon, which didn't do it immediately, but it was a 5/5 flyer for 6. You could pay 4 in a red to just shatter something, and then its power got pumped based on the CMC of the card. There was, there was obviously the Contagion Engine, which was just 6 mana artifact. When ETB'd, all their creatures got -1/-1 counter, and you proliferated. I guess you proliferated again. You put it just did busted stuff. There were a million Plague Winds in the format, but I had Skitherix. I'm reading it now. Yeah, it has flying and infect, and you can pay black to give it haste and double black to regenerate it. That's what it did. Five mana 4. So it was like the big haste dragon of the set. And then Carnivex Demon was the black 6 drop that wrathed your board because, you know, every color had to have one. So I was like, well, all these cards are double black, but I'm pretty sure I can make the mana work. And I was like, my deck was just completely busted. So I'm like super confident. Like, my deck's great. It's probably to this day the best sealed pool I've ever opened. And I lose round 1. Years later, I went back and looked, and it was like a name that you would recognize, but I can't remember. Like, that, you know, so an opponent that was clearly competent, but I didn't know who they were at the time. And just losing it all round 1 of a PTQ, especially one where, like, we had driven, you know, 5 hours.
Yeah.
And I, like, really cared. This is like the peak of me, like, caring about, like, my results in tournaments like this. So after I lost, I just, like, I did, like, the classic Ross thing, like the PCLE match, where I just, like, sat at the table with my cards still out and just, like, looked at them for 10 minutes.
The Hello Darkness, my old friend moment.
Yeah, exactly. I had one of those moments.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, dude, like, you got to crush this PTQ. And so I went out through the rest of the Swiss until the last round. But I'm X1, but I lost round 1, so I can't draw. And I sit down across from someone. It's also a name you would know, but I don't want to throw them another bus. This was like 12 years ago. I knew of them. Like, I knew their name from the, you know, East Coast tournament scene, but I don't really know them. And we sit down across from each other. And obviously, like, they didn't know me. Nobody knew who I was. And the first thing they tell me is that, like, they had watched my previous match, so they knew my deck. They were, like, bragging about it in this weird way. And at first I was like, well, that's kind of weird. Like, I'd had a very long match the round previously. And I'm trying to remember who I played in that match. It was also somebody you would know, and I can't remember their name. But, you know, very long, close match, really good match. They were fine. But, like, you know, we were, like, one of the last matches, so there was a crowd around us. And but I thought about it for a second after I, like, got over the shock of my opponent just, like, kind of being a dick to me straight off the bat. And I just thought, I was like, I never drew Skitherix in that match. For as long as it was, like, deep 3 games, I just never drew it in any of the games. I was like, okay, that's good to know. So my opponent knows I have, you know, Carnivex Demon, and they, like, they probably know about the Stratoscythe and the equipment stuff, but they don't know about the Skitherix. And that's a card that, like, you can really surprise somebody with. So that's good. So I just filed that one in my back pocket. I was like, okay, they don't know about this one. And game 1, we're sitting there and we're just, like, playing Magic, and my opponent Sunblast Angels me, and I'm just dead. I'm like, okay, that's cool. Turns out their deck had Sunblast Angel, True Conviction, which was 3 white enchantment. Your creatures get double strike and lifelink. Yeah. And then and Hordesmelter Dragon. That was their deck. So they also had 3 bombs. There were just so many bombs in this format. But there were also, like, there was a ton of removal, so you could answer bombs a lot more easily. That's why I kind of liked it. But I lose game 1. I just, you know, got Sunblast Angeled in a, you know, a spot where I had to be aggressive. So we shuffle up, and game 2, I Skitherix them on, like, you know, turn 5 or 6. And as soon as I played it, they did the, like, double take
Ushka,
back.
Ushka, yeah.
Yeah, they're just like, what? And I knew, I was like, yeah, they had no idea this was coming. And, you know, I had it in my opening hand, so I played the entire game to, like, you know, set it up in a good spot. And they didn't play around it, of course. And so Skitherix carried the game. So we go to game three, and I mulligan to five. And so my opponent is obviously, like, feeling great. They kept seven. And this is, you know, back in the old days, this is even pre-Vancouver. So there's not even a, I don't even get a scry. I just get five cards and hope for the best. My five card hand is Sunspear Shikari, Stratoscythe, the rare equipment, Plains, Swamp, and then Forest, because I splashed a Silvok replica as greedily as possible in my deck, which I definitely shouldn't have done, but I did. So my Stratoscythe isn't as good as it could have been, but I'm still like, this is a pretty great five. So all I do is play the Shikari at two, like, hope it lives, it did. Play the Scythe on three, hope it lives, it did. Equip on four, and I'm just slamming in for five. Because I managed to draw, like multiple of either Plains or Swamp. I don't remember which one. Mm-hmm. Like, sure. Those are my draws. So I'm just, I made it a 5-5 on turn four with lifelink, and I'm just attacking over and over and over again. And then my opponent, like, you know, I still don't have much else going on. So eventually, like, my opponent goes to five, and eventually, like, finds an answer to it, and starts turning the game around. I'm like, damn, like, I gave it a good run with my five-card hand, but looks like I'm just kind of, you know, getting screwed here, losing to another really good deck. But then I just rip Carnivex Demon and win the game of Carnivex Demon in the air. Not even, like, dealing with threats. It was just, next turn, I you know, removed the counters from it, and it was a 6-6 and finished him off.
Yeah, attack you. Yeah,
from
yeah.
Five. And so I'm like, sweet, I won. I'm on top of this PTQ. I'm great. My opponent picks up their deck, you know, gets their cards together, picks out the three rares. Mind you, these rares, as good as they were in Limited, were not worth anything at the time. I don't know if any of them have become Commander staples and are worth bajillions now, but they were, you know, these were nearly bulk rares. Like, maybe you get a quarter for them from a vendor, right? And I'm pretty sure they were shuffling unsleeved. So, you know, but, like, takes the time to, like, pick out their rares and takes the rest of their deck and throws it down the table. Now, we went pretty long, so there were no matches being played along this table, no other matches, but, like, the cards just, like, went everywhere. And they just did it without saying, like, a word to me. They just threw it down the table, and I'm just looking around like, is that, nobody's going to do anything? But that's, those are the personalities that you ran into at PTQs around that time. So I make the top eight, and this is, like, midway through the season-ish. And early, for people that never, like, played these kind of sealed PTQs in this era, there was always, like, a deck that people didn't quite understand early in the season that was the deck to force in, like, a top eight draft at a PTQ. And slowly, as people learned it, you would adjust, you know, your tactics. Drafting at the end of the season was different than drafting at the beginning. Early in the season, you just wanted to be the Infect drafter. Because everybody was practicing a bunch of sealed to make sure that they were good at sealed, and most pools you couldn't really infect, but it was very good in draft, and so people tended to underrate those decks, and they overrated, like, artifacts and artifact removal. So they took, like, and the infect decks usually didn't have as many artifacts. They also didn't care about the artifact removal as a result. So, you know, forcing infect was good. So that was my, like, plan going in, and I did it, like, right at the time where everybody had sort of caught on. So I ended up, like, fighting at the table and drafting this really mediocre deck, and I kind of figured it out through the draft, but I opened one of the Infect rares in pack two, and that kind of kept me in it. My deck was not that good, but, like, it was okay. And I ended up losing in the top four to a punt of mine. I honestly don't remember exactly what the punt was, but it was, like, an obvious punt where, like, I had just been playing all day, barely slept, I, like, missed something on board and lost. So, despite being my best result of the season, I am sitting in the back of the car on the 4.5-hour drive back with my, you know, my loser box of Magic cards, yeah. With my loser box, my steak knives, and I'm just like, God damn it. I could not, but, like, you can't punt matches like that. I had, like, the awesome sealed pool. I am good. I need to help. At this point, I hadn't played a Pro Tour, keep in mind, and I'm just, like, beating myself up the whole ride home. Like, I had, like, two or three more chances this season. I was like, I gotta fucking convert. So a couple weeks later, we're at a PTQ in Boston, and I had, like, a typical sealed pool. I'm red-white again, and I start like 3-0. I think I lost round 4. I'm 3-1. And I like win round 5, or I'm 4-1. I think it's 8 rounds of Swiss. One of the later rounds, maybe around 5, maybe like 6 or 7, I'm like hanging out after the previous round, still in the same room. And I just like didn't hear the announcement for pairings like at all. And I'm in that room. So I don't know exactly what happened, if I was just distracted. I just didn't hear it. I like look up at one point from whatever I'm doing between rounds with my friends and see that like people are sitting down. I'm like, oh shit, like run up to the pairings board, see where I am, run over there. And I'm like 5 minutes late, but this was one of those penalties that had no leeway. So I got a game loss. I'm like, God damn it. I'm X1. I'm like, I can't lose another match. But I managed to win games 2 and 3. So no harm, no foul. But I'm giving myself like the Saito slap, like get your head in the game.
Yeah.
And I'm playing the next round, like a round after that. I'm playing my winning in. And I'm in game 3, and I'm losing. I'd fallen behind, and my life total was kind of low. I had to like use it as a resource to stabilize on board. And my opponent at one point played a Barrage Ogre, which is 3 red-red for a 3/3, and you can tap, sack an artifact to shock something. It can go upstairs. And I was at 4, and my opponent had 2 artifacts. And I didn't draw that. I had 2 Tartar Slags in my deck. I'd already used one, so I was hoping to draw the second one that turn. I didn't. And I'm like, shit, like I'm just dead. My opponent just has to throw 2 artifacts at me. So I sit there and think for a while. I was like, maybe I can get them to throw it at something else if I give them a really juicy target. And I don't know exactly how I did it, but like I presented them like a 2 or 3 for 1. And I was like, you want to kill this? This looks good to kill. And I start doing something, and I do the thing where I like try to like fake trying to do it like kind of fast, like I'm trying to get one over on them, and so that they'll see it and be like, no, I'm going to let this person get one over on me, but I actually am getting one over on them. And they took the bait, and they barraged ogred my thing, and then untapped, like didn't have another artifact, or didn't have, like only had could only get me to 2, and now I'm just like, okay, I got 1 turn, let's hope this works. And I ripped the turn to slag. Kill my opponent's Barrage Ogre and win the game and the match. And from that moment, I was like, oh, I'm just winning this PGQ.
Yeah. It's destined.
It's happening. So I get to the top 8 draft, and this was the week after GP Nashville. And this was a GP that Jerry Thompson won, and he beat Ari Lax in the finals. And they both had very unique decks for this format. Jerry drafted a blue Metalcraft deck with 4 Surtarks in it. I think was it Vidalcan Surtark? I think it's Vidalcan Surtark, but it was blue for a 1/1. And if you had Metalcraft, you could, it was a tapper. Just tap to tap something, Icy Manipulator. Tapped a creature or an artifact. Maybe it was even land. I don't know. The card was like busted if you had Metalcraft, but in order to get Metalcraft consistently, you needed like 16, 17 artifacts. And then you just didn't have room for other things. You needed a removal. So the card generally wasn't very good. But he had like a million artifacts, and like those were his non-artifacts. It was a really coolly built deck. It was one of those decks that like only comes together in a very specific draft. So his deck was busted. He won it. But Ari drafted what became one of like the known archetypes of the format for the last like month of the season. It was called Green-Red Dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm. And I remember this, yeah.
Yeah, you wanted to draft a Fumir. You wanted to use the good red removal, but instead of pairing it with Poopy White, which had extra removal, but you didn't really need that, mm-hmm. It didn't have as good of a high end, you paired it with big green creatures. There was a 6-mana, 6/5 vanilla, Alpha Tyrannax, that was reasonably solid in the format, and then there was a Molder Beast. It was a 5-mana, 3/3 trample, and whenever an artifact died, it got +2/+0 until end of turn. It might have needed something to die to get trampled to, but like, big trampler. They were like oddly difficult to kill because like Galvanic Blast, you would couldn't kill the 5 toughness thing, and sometimes couldn't kill the Molder guy, and they were just like most of the creatures in the set were pretty small. Like artifact creatures tend to be small, and so it worked pretty well. So I go into this draft thinking like, I'm gonna try to draft this deck. This is where I'm going, and I open Arc Trail, one of the best uncommons, and I'm like, great. Not only is this an awesome card, it goes into, goes very well in my deck. I also open Oxida Scrap Melter, the other great red uncommon. So I situate myself in red. I get the green cards late, basically exactly how you wanted to go. Like the green cards would all table because people were fighting over like the red and white cards, and you would just take the good, the premium red cards early. And my deck was awesome. and I win the top eight pretty easily. My top four opponent is like the one infect person. And I beat them. And then the finals, I played against the person playing Furnace Celebration, which was one of the niche archetypes.
Yeah.
It was the build around uncommon. But they only had one copy of Furnace Celebration. They like went in on it early and they just never got the second copy to really make their deck good. But if they drew their Furnace Celebration, their deck was quite good. So I win game one. They find the Furnace Celebration game two. They win that one. And so we go to game three. And my draw is quite good. I have the Arc Trail. That's important. So I'm just like, you know, going through my mental Rolodex of cards that I've seen and is like hoping they play into this Arc Trail. Well, they play a mirror on turn two. I'm like, great start. Now I just need them to play something on turn three that like has two toughness. As I'm making my like scripted plays, just thinking like what in their deck would do that? And I remember they had a Moriok replica. And I'm like, please. So I pass the turn and I'm just mentally crossing my fingers. I'm like, Moriok replica, please. Just one time. Just play the Moriok replica. And they did. And I Arc Trailed them and the game was never close. So that was the first PTQ I won. And it was also kind of funny because like my friends were still there with like full car, like five or six people, and they just had no one with them. And my friends are just like standing behind me because they got nothing else to do. And there's like two judges. And my opponent just has no one. After I won, they just like got in their car alone and sped off.
That's sad.
Yeah. But winning this PTQ required me, like my opponent, to just like throw away a game that I had no business winning with the Barrage Ogre. That was like the first season where I probably played more than three PTQs and I won one of them. So it makes me think like I probably should have been playing more PTQs when I was 16.
Probably.
Yeah. I could have been somebody. I could have been a contender.
I mean, the key is volume when it comes to a lot of magic stuff. Yeah. Like you're just putting in more terms, you're going to have better results. Kind of like looking over this set and the one before, you know, the Zendikar block and the Scars Veridon block as a whole. A lot of stuff going on here, too. This was sort of like, this is the start of like the golden age of magic and magic coverage. Like SCG is starting to do stuff, starting to do opens. TCG player was doing stuff because I'll mention that in a moment. Something I involved, got involved with that for a tiny bit. Magic cards are getting more expensive in standard. You may have heard us mention this on a prior one about like $10 or $15 might have been like the most expensive card standard. Now you're having like Termagoyf happen, and Jace the Mind Sculptor has come into Magic at this point. It started to happen.
There was also Gideon Juro was $40 for a while.
Yeah, and that kind of jumps into my like one of the stories I have is like I said, I wasn't around much, but I don't think Scars was out yet. I'm not sure. Maybe Scars had just come out, and there was a TCG player like event in New Orleans, and we never get like anything here, right? It ended up being really small. You know, there was an open here and there was a TCG, there's a SCG open here and there was a TCG player thing, and both of them are very small. Anyway, so I go play the TCG thing and I did get this like blue black control deck from a friend or whatever, right? Literally never played Desolate, never anything. Play out my first match, and in one of the games I play Jace the Mind Sculptor. And like, I've seen coverage. I know the card is considered good. At the time, it hadn't really, really taken over yet because Jund was doing a very good job of keeping it in place.
Yeah,
now you don't
until you have Gideon to really protect the Jace, sure. It wasn't as good.
Yeah, and like, you know, now it's starting to really set itself apart, you know, and I don't think Callblade had made its self known yet.
Callblade was the mirrored and besieged Pro Tour, so.
Sure, yeah. So Callblade hadn't really happened yet. I think it was starting to happen. I think Scars might have been out. Anyway, so I'm playing this blue-light control.
So Callblade started as Cog Go that Kibler played at Worlds that year. So that was, you know, December. That was the one that the Guillaumes made the finals of with Demir.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly when this was. I kind of have the idea, right? Yeah. So like I just come back to Magic, kind of like I wasn't even sure I was back, but I just like play this event because there's like, you know, like a 10K or a 20K or whatever, like down the an hour away. So I go play in it. I remember like I think I win my first round or whatever. And I come over to my friends, you know, like the LGS people, and they're like, "How'd your round go?" And I'm like, "I won" or whatever. They're like, "You know, like how was it or whatever?" You know, because like they know I'm like kind of, you know, thinking about coming back or whatever. And I was like, "This Jace card is really messed up." And they're like, "Yeah." And I was like, "Yeah, like, you know, I played it, like brainstormed a few times or like bounced a creature, did other things. But like, I was like, yeah, we played this match and like I got ahead in game three And I just like played a Jace. They're like, yeah. And I was like, I just plus two'd and kept the card on top of their deck. And they were like, yeah, yeah. I was like, how is this fair? I was like, this felt so bad. Like, and like you could see it on, like, you know, I'm a poker player. I could like see it on my opponent's face. So I was like, yeah, you can keep it. They were just like, oh, I'm dead. You know, kind of thing, yeah. You know, like, I'm like, yeah, like, I'm like, this is awful. And then I did it again, like the next turn or whatever. I was like, yeah, you can keep it. Cause like, it's either a card that doesn't do anything or a card I have an answer to. And yeah. I was like, this is miserable. And we had to deal with this for quite a while, actually. And then, you know, we get through Scars of Mirrodin. I remember my LGS started getting really into competitive Magic at this time, too. Because, like I said, you're starting to get Magic on Twitch a lot. This is when it's starting to get, you're starting to get, like, weekly, bi-weekly events, you know, going on Twitch. And you're getting a lot of coverage. The metagames are moving much faster now. Like, we're starting to have information be way more readily available. And I still remember people in my LGS, like, burning through packs trying to find chase cards. Like, what was the red-white sword? Sword of War and Peace? People would be, like, excited when they opened that because it was, like, a $50 card when, you know, Callblade was a thing because it was, like, the card for the mirror and all this other stuff. And I just remember Magic being very different then than, like, where it was when I left it, like, a few years before. You know, like, the prices of stuff is changing. We're getting coverage. It's probably another reason why I came back to it.
We're starting to transition into, like, the modern age of Magic.
Sure.
At
yeah,
this time.
And, yeah, and this all leads... Are you pretty much done with the Scars of Mirrodin block?
Mm. Oh, no, I'm going to talk about the Pro Tour.
Okay, sure, the Pro Tour that you qualified for. I thought you were like... I didn't know which one you qualified. I thought you were kind of done. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, my first Pro Tour was Pro Tour Paris. The Callblade Pro Tour.
Sure. I'm assuming you didn't have the Callblade deck.
No. I did play the only other viable deck, as it turns out.
Wasn't this the first Pro Tour where they, like... really tried to make it a go of it? Like, didn't also have the Grand Prix going
yes,
on at, like,
the
same time?
Yes, they called them Magic Weekends.
Yeah, that's right. Okay,
they never did it again. They tried to, like, turn the Pro Tour into this big spectacle.
It did not work in the way they wanted it to, I don't think.
Like, there used to be side events at Pro Tours, like, you know, last episode I talked about, the PTQs and stuff I played at Hollywood. You know, so there used to be public events, but it wasn't a huge event, you know, the Pro Tour.
It wasn't a spectacle.
Like, yes. Yeah. And so they tried to turn it into a spectacle in Paris, and they did what they called Magic Weekend. So what they did was they had the Pro Tour start on a Thursday, not a Friday. You played day one Thursday, then day two on Friday. But then Saturday, there was a Grand Prix.
Because was it like Paul Rietzel double queuing?
Yes.
Something? Yeah, and they were letting him? Yeah.
We were told that we shouldn't do that. I will tell you that. I'll let you know that. Right now, that if we were still in the Pro Tour, we shouldn't be trying to double queue. So, because Sunday, day two of the Grand Prix, was going to be top eight of the Pro Tour. Because he was playing, I must have gotten the schedules wrong, because he was playing day two of the Pro Tour at the same, no, I think it was his top eight that he was still playing. Yeah, he was playing the top eight. So, we were told, like, if we were in contention for top eight of the Pro Tour, we shouldn't play a GP. Not that, like, you because, you know, it was Thursday, Friday were your Swiss days for the Pro Tour. Then Saturday, Sunday were your normal days for the GP. But if you were in top eight of the Pro Tour, like, obviously, like, you couldn't play the GP. And Paul was just like, bet. He ended up top eighting both, even though he had to forfeit a match in the GP to play his top eight match in the Pro Tour.
Yeah. I think Kai had a good weekend, too, if I remember
right. Kai top eighted that GP, yep.
Yeah. Kind of out of, like, coming back a little bit, kind of out of nowhere. You know, we haven't heard from him in a while.
Yeah, it was sort of his first big finish since Amsterdam.
Yeah, like...
which I guess it was only, like, a year or so before.
Yeah, kind of backing up a tiny bit for, like, 2 seconds to the last one. I talked about, you know, how I did well with that Grand Prix, and then I didn't even go to the Pro Tour that I qualified for because it was just too expensive, et cetera, et cetera. Like... that's the Pro Tour that Finkel was like, yeah, I'll just show up. And he just wins. It was Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. So it's at this time, we're starting to get some of the old heads coming out as well. Again, the guys that had dominated like the 90s and very early 2000s.
Yeah. You know, Kibler was back at this point.
Yep. I think the Hall of Fame maybe had gotten announced around this time.
Hall of Fame was in 2005. So
some of these people are starting to utilize the Hall of Fame.
But,
that's what
but,
it is.
Yeah, okay. I think Kibler didn't get in until after he came back and put up a bunch of top eights.
Yeah, and then won a Pro Tour. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Because his early career, like he won a GP at very young. He top eighted one Pro Tour, but that was it.
Yeah, then he went on to like go design other games. And
yeah,
stuff.
Exactly. Like he left pretty early before he had put up. You
and
know,
he went to go do like Versus System and like a bunch of other stuff. Then he got involved with like WoW and
He helped design Ascension right with
yeah. There's a bunch of stuff. He had his hands in a bunch of different things.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that so the Hall of Fame, I think, like, motivated him to come back so he could get
into
it.
Because he wanted to. Yeah, there was a multiple people who came back because they're like, I need like one or two more finishes to get into the Hall of Fame. Yeah,
I think so. We were starting to see the effect of that by this point, because this is Paris is winter of 2011. Okay. Kuala Lumpur was like 07 or 08, the one that Kibler won, or the Finkel one.
Finkel one, yeah.
But okay, so the Cobley Pro Tour. I like did some testing with my friends, like, you know, what I could. I wasn't playing Moto at the time because I'm an idiot, and I just have never liked playing Magic Online, to be honest.
Same-ish.
Yeah, but the deck that I liked in Standard was the Teamer Lotus Cobra deck. It's sort of a ported over from the block deck that Paolo won PT San Juan with the previous June. You know, Lotus Cobra, Jace, Oracle. One of my favorite decks of all time was from that previous summer, which was the Turbo Land deck that was Jace, Oracle, Rampant Growth, Explore, and it won with Time Warp plus Avenger of Zendikar. You would just like get to 12 mana in play with lands as early as like turn 5 or 6 and just go like Avenger, play a land, play a Time Warp next turn, play a bunch more lands and kill you. And it was super fun. This was like, you know, a souped up version of that. It had, you know, red for Lightning Bolt and stuff like that. And so I just like locked that deck in early rather than try to like test a bunch. And that deck ended up being quite good. It was the second best performing deck by win rate in the field. Of course, being less experienced than I am now, I got scared by, the idea of the Kuldotha Rebirth deck, which during preview season for Besiege, people talked about, and I like looks powerful. It's in, one of those just like all in Bushwhacker kind of decks. And it was very good against the Lotus Cobra deck. And I'm just like, oh, I'm like worried about this. I ended up like cutting a Lightning Bolt from my deck and playing like main deck Anger of the Gods or whatever sweeper that we had. It wasn't Anger. Maybe it wasn't Anger of the Gods. It was because that was Theros block, but there was some one red like sweeper. Like I made some like bad choices in my deck. Trying to like overly metagame it. I of course had no idea like Cobblade existed at this point. Like Demure Control from Worlds was like the best deck.
Yeah, that's the deck I think I had played like part of it that I had played before. Yeah,
yeah, it was like the most played decks were Demure Control and red green Primetime Valakut.
What was it like being at a pro tour where a deck breaks out like that? Was it like almost disheartening for your team? You realize like, We're screwed. Like, this deck's just unreal. Like,
I wasn't on a team. I was just alone.
Sure.
I actually went there with my friend Brian, back from that, the PTQ I won, as we were driving up there. He just says, like, if anybody wins the PTQ, I'm going to go with them, because I kind of want to go to Paris, but I don't want to go alone.
Yeah. You play the Grand Prix.
Obviously, like none of us thought about that. Like, we had, our entire team combined had gone to two PTs at this point.
Yeah,
in
my
first
PT, I traveled with three people, but only two of us played. Like, one of the guys that came with us was just like, I want to go to London. Yeah.
But I won the PTQ, and on the way back, I was like, Ryan, like, you want to come with me? And he's like, yeah, of course, let's do it. Sounds awesome.
Yeah.
So he came with me, which was fun. He LCQ'd, as an aside. So the Pro Tour in Paris was in the Champs-Élysées area, which is like the northwest part of the city. And Paris has this like highway in a circle around it. And so we're in like the northwest part of the circle. And the LCQ was at some like store location that was in all the way on the opposite side in the southeast portion of the city. So it started sometime in the like late afternoon. We made our way over there. But I was going to just let Ryan play the LCQ while I went to Père Lachaise Cemetery, which is over there, has a bunch of like famous people that are buried there. And then I was going to make my way into the center of the city and go to the Cluny Museum, which is their medieval history museum, and like do my sightseeing. And but I watched Brian like build his sealed pool, and it was not good. Like, just it was like a 3 out of 10, 4 tops.
Yay.
Yeah. And I just told him when he was done, I was like, Brian, there's like, you're my
don't
friend.
Waste your time. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't waste your time. Like, you just, you're not going to win. Like, the winning.
Enjoy Paris or so something. Yeah.
For people that also don't know this, like, there used to be LCQs for the Pro Tour. The day before, they were usually limited. And you would just, like, play this tournament where you with, like, a couple hundred people where you had to go, like, X1. You know, like go like 8-1.
You pretty much can't lose.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Sometimes you can lose, to, like, you know, or you could be like 8-1 with really good breakers, right?
You could lose like the last round, maybe.
Yeah. And so, like with sealed, you just had to have a really good pool and like grind your way through. You would finish at like 2 a.m. and then have to like find a deck for the Pro Tour, mm-hmm. And stuff like that. But like, you know, it was a thing for every Pro Tour. You could LCQ in, and like 4 people would make it. I just told him, I was like, why like waste a day in Paris? Like, just come with me, like go see something. He's like, nah, like I want to give it a shot. I was like, okay. And so I left him. I completely forgot to go to Père Lachaise, and I went straight to the Cluny Museum, which was fucking awesome. It was it was on the grounds of a medieval castle in the middle of Paris. So I'm like, you know, walk in like typical tourist. My phone doesn't work because it's like pre-smartphone. I didn't get an international plan for my brick phone. They had like computers set up in the site. So I was like using Facebook on like my computer there. Actually, this is before I made a Facebook account. I didn't even have Facebook, but like, probably like checking my email or something.
AOL Instant Messenger.
Yeah. No, I was still using AIM. Yeah. yeah. Just to like communicate with people. Like this is, you know, it was 2011. It was a different world. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you know, walking along and I'm just like in this urban area, like, you know, by the Seine. And I just look and it's just a fucking castle. I'm like, I think this is where I'm going. I like go in. It's a small museum. It had like 14 rooms. It took like 2 or 3 hours to see absolutely everything in it. There was an entire room dedicated to games, like old dice and playing cards and stuff. That was really cool. So, yeah, I spent a lot of time in Paris not playing so much Magic, especially the week leading up to it, because I didn't really have a team. I was like, well, I'm just going to sit there and like jam games against Brian. Like, that's not going to help. Like, I've got my deck done. I didn't get to test like any limited. So this like Magic weekend and the Pro Tour, it was the week after the pre-release. The pre-release was the previous weekend, and I was flying out that like Tuesday. So I couldn't, and this was, you couldn't even buy like, you know, product at the pre-release. You could just like use what you won. And if you remember, the Mirrodin Besieged pre-release, because there was this whole like Mirrodins versus Phyrexians kind of thing, had the faction packs.
You had to pick a side, yeah.
Yeah, that were like seeded, and you would like pick which side you wanted to represent. This is when they started really like playing with pre-releases and doing weird things to the packs. So the packs you got at the pre-release were not the packs that you were going to draft with. Mm-hmm. This was a big problem. Like, people had to like collect, like, people like, you know, got a bunch of cards together and were like making cubes basically out of them to try to, you know, test this limit format. I just like didn't really test. I'm like, yeah, fuck it. Like, yeah. I didn't have a group that I could get in with. I didn't know anybody. So I basically didn't. I was like, we're still drafted 2 Scars packs. Like, I know what's going on. I did not draft particularly well in the 3rd pack, but.
Narrator's voice. He did not know what was going on.
Yeah. I was like, you know what? Like, I'm going to do what I can, and I'm going to enjoy Paris. Like, you know, whatever happens, happens. And you know, I registered my teamer, Lotus Cobra deck, and back then you started with Constructed. You did the draft at the end of the day. And I sit down for round 1, and my nightmare happens. I play against the Golgotha Rebirth deck, which was not good. It had a horrible weekend, but my opponent just had 2 very good draws with the deck and beat me by, like, turn 3 both games. I, of course, like, didn't draw my main deck sweeper like an idiot playing, like, weird niche cards like that. And I literally looked up the clock as we handed the match slip to the judge, and there was more than 50 minutes on the clock, because you used to get 55 minutes at Pro Tours. My opponent had beaten me in under 5 minutes. I'm like, well, great way to start my Pro Tour career, I guess. I ended up going, I think I 2-3'd Constructed. And so I've got and also back then you had to 5-3 to day 2. So you know, I'm at the table where it's like, one of us is going to day 2, you know, whoever 3-0's is pod. I 1-2'd the draft. I did not day 2. Played the GP, didn't day 2 the GP. Played a PTQ on whatever other day, you know, that Sunday. And it was extended. I loved my extended deck. Ended up like X2-ing and at like top 16. I did win a match where my opponent, they were playing the Sovereigns of Lost Alara deck, but they call it Bant Mythic because there was a bunch of Mythic rares. Yeah. But do you know Sovereigns of Lost Alara? It was like a 6-mana.
I see it,
like,
in my mind. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a 6-mana 4/5 and like a 4 blue-white. And yeah. When it attacked, you like just searched the library for an aura and attached it to it. So they would search for an Eldrazi Conscription.
Yeah. It was like, yeah, we called it Mythic Conscription for a while.
Yeah. Mythic Conscription. So I won a game where my opponent attacked me with a creature that had two mythic inscriptions on it, and I got Annihilator Ford. So that's the third time it attacked. And I just, like, you know, I was playing this, like, blue-white control deck that I built. I top-aided a PTQ with it, like, the month before. I thought I was going to win back-to-back PTQs, actually. And because this was extended before, obviously, Cobblade hit. There was, like, 3 weeks of this weird extended format that happened, and we had a PTQ that January. And, like, Fairies was sort of the best deck. And I built... I played the blue... It was a blue-white, like, tap-out control deck with Sun Titan. And, it was actually a fun story, but it was a, it played like Kitchen Finks, you know, Mana Leak, you know, had like two Sun Titans at the top end, a couple Bane Slayers, which was sometimes like hard to kill because the fairy decks were all playing Grasp of Darkness because it matched up well against different threats in the format. And, I also had this like transitional sideboard where I lowered my curve against them, and everybody had a bunch of War Priest of Thunes to blow up Bitter Blossoms. But I also added in Coral Helm Commanders. Just like turn me into like a fish deck, basically. But I was a fish deck where like, so I could try to like get ahead of them. I could deal with Bitter Blossom. And then as soon as they like tapped out to answer stuff, I had a few over the top threats like Baneslayer Angel. And that was sort of my plan in the matchup. And one round in the Swiss, my opponent Thought Seizes me. Sees two copies of War Priest of Thune that were in my hand. Takes one of them. I draw a third. And I of course assume that they have a Bitter Blossom. But I'm like, oh, I drew a third. So I just play one out as a Grizzly Bear on turn two because you want to pressure the Fairies deck. And so my opponent just draws and like plays their Bitter Blossom. I immediately play my third War Priest and blow it up, and they like blew up at me. They were so mad. They're just like, I can't believe you drew a third one. That's so lucky. I'm just like, dude. You didn't think that was a sign when I played one? Like, if you didn't have Bitter Blossom, you're not taking Grizzly Bear out of my hand with that Thought Seize. You'll take something else. So clearly you have Bitter Blossom, and I know it. And that I play my answer to it? You don't think I've got another one? I, of course, like didn't say this to them, but it's just another example of the way people were. But I top-aided this PTQ, and now I'm like thinking, like, I just won my last PTQ. I'm in the top eight of this one. I'm the fucking shit. I'm going to queue for multiple, like, back-to-back Pro Tours. I'm great. And I play against Max Brown in the top eight, who I didn't know at the time. He won an Invitational years later. New York player. And he was playing the one of the niche decks of that extended metagame that existed for, like, exactly a month. It was, like, a teamer mid-range deck that had Pestermite Kiki-Jiki. Because you couldn't play Twin... I don't know why you couldn't play Twin, but maybe Kiki-Jiki was just better. He had Pestermite Kiki-Jiki in it, but it also had, like, Jace and, you know, Tarmogoyf and stuff like that.
I remember
that.
This. Yeah,
Lightning Bolt.
All the good cards.
Yeah, and we go to game three in our quarterfinal match, and he mulligans to four.
To four.
And again, this is no scries. You don't get to draw seven, put three back. You just grip four cards and go. Yeah.
Sorry, baby.
And I'm like, my hand is good. I'm like, yeah, let's, like, this is going to be easy. And he was on the play. Oh, it's not Kiki. It was Pester Twin. Yeah, he was playing Pester Twin.
He's playing Teamer Twin, yeah.
Yeah, basically playing Teamer Twin. Like, before, you know, Teamer Twin was a thing. And it gets to my turn three. He's done nothing. He's just played three lands, and none of them produce red mana. He was on the play, so he has three cards in his hand. He has no access to red mana. It gets to my turn three. I have Mana Leak in hand, but I also have a Kitchen Finks. So I'm like, well, I want to like start pressuring him. And I was like, even if he play, like he, I had like an answer to a Pestermite in hand too. So he like plays one out, waits to Splinter Twin it in two turns when he has two red mana. I'll have multiple answers. I'll be fine. So I just like tap out for my Kitchen Finks, thinking everything's fine. And he just shows me the three cards in his hand, and they are Splinter Twin, Pestermite, Cascade Bluffs.
Dead. Cascade Bluffs did a lot of heavy lifting in that deck.
Yeah.
I remember this now, yeah.
I think of like there were, I think it was like him and a bunch of fairies decks in the top four, and I loved my fairies matchup. I thought I was gonna win that PTQ. So yeah, I got Dream Crush there. But back to the Pro Tour. Like I don't day two the GP. Like, you know, I'd like min cash this like PTQ. So I had a horrible weekend playing Magic. I had a great weekend in Paris. We saw a bunch of cool shit, ate a bunch of good food. So that was fun. We did have a bear of a time getting home. So we were flying out like a red eye That Monday night, Monday after the Pro Tour, which was Valentine's Day, by the way, we went to the Eiffel Tower on Valentine's Day. That was romantic. But then, so we did that in the morning, and then afterwards we went to the Louvre for the afternoon because I wanted to go to the Louvre, but like on a day where I had a bunch of time and to see as much as I can in it because it's fucking gigantic. And I'm dragging Brian through all of the wings with all the history stuff. We didn't look at much of the art. I did see the Mona Lisa. It was shit. But I'm dragging him through the history stuff, being like, you know, pointing out all the stuff. And I'm like running through the museum to try to see everything. And Brian is just like 20 feet behind me, dragging his feet the entire time, just humoring me. But we spent like 3 hours in the Louvre. And then he got his mom a bottle of wine. And then we, you know, went to go to the airport because we were going to have to take public transit. It's going to take a while. And there's two stops for Charles de Gaulle Airport, depending on which terminal you need. And
the worst airport in Europe, by the way. Literally just one of the worst.
Well, we weren't exactly sure which terminal we would need. The signs weren't clear about that. And obviously, look, we didn't have internet access. So we just kind of guessed. You know, we got off at the first one. We're like, okay, we'll try that. And so, you know, we go up the stairs into the terminal and we don't find something for our airlines. We're like, okay, I guess we need to go to the other one. Then we, you know, get back on a subway. We go to the other stop. We get there. We check in. And then before we go to security, Brian is like, hold on a second. I just want to put this wine bottle, you know, the bottle of wine that I bought for my mom, into my luggage, into his checked bag, I guess, because, you know, this is, we probably couldn't take it through security. This is still post 9/11.
Yeah.
So he like opens his suitcase and tries to like, you know, cradle the bottle of wine. So, you know, hopefully it doesn't break. And as he's doing that, he like moves the Ziploc bag that he has all his toiletries in like out of the way, and he does it kind of nonchalantly, and somehow like cuts himself on his razor, and now he's just bleeding.
Nice.
And it's not like super serious where he needs like medical attention, but like he needs a Band-Aid.
Yeah.
And we don't
There's
have
blood.
Yeah. And like we don't have one, and so I like quickly like go get him. Like I don't know what we used. I probably got like tissues or paper towels in the bathroom or something. And, you know, put that on it. He gets his, you know, he gets his thing done. Gets his wine bottle situated. We drop off the luggage. We go through security. And he's just, like, clamping his finger as we walk through security. We get some weird looks. But we get through. And then once we're through, I take his bags. And I bring them with me to the gate while he goes into, you know, the shopping part of big airports and goes to find some Band-Aids. So I'm sitting there at the gate with all of his stuff, just sitting there waiting. They had like game console set up. That was kind of fun. I think I played some racing game. And I was like, this is the best airport. It was like PS3s.
Well, I think you're saying that right after I was talking about how awful the airport is, because it really is an awful airport anyway.
Continue. Yeah. So I'm just sitting there and like, Brian's just like not coming. I figured it would take him like 10 minutes, right? Like, how long does it take to go find a fucking Band-Aid? And he's like not coming, and eventually we get the call to start boarding, and they do the whole rigmarole of like letting people that paid them more money on the plane first. And I start, you know, getting a little worried because they start like calling our row, but we've got time. It's a huge flight, so rather than getting in line, I go up to the desk,
explain what's going on,
the service desk, and try to like explain to them what's going on, and they are not cooperative at all. And I feel like I'm not explaining it to me, and I started asking them. I was like, can I just like leave his bags here? And like, he'll be here. Like, he'll come. But I just thought, like, I don't want to bring his bags with me and leave him with nothing in case he has to like get a hotel for the night if he misses it. Like, I'm just trying to like weigh my options. And the only thing they are telling me is, you know, unattended bag, €800 fine from the police. And I'm like, that's not the question I'm asking you. And I'm getting frustrated. And there's just like no back and forth. And you would think, like, everyone has spoken English throughout my entire time in Paris, but somehow the people at the airport, the major international airport, are not understanding. I don't really get it. And I'm starting to get worried, and I'm just like, I make up in my mind, I'm like, I'm just going to leave his shit here. And like, he's the one who's going to get fined. It's his stuff. But like, I'm not missing this flight. But he managed to come through like, you know, 5 minutes before like they were going to close the doors. Somehow it took him like, you know, 45 minutes to an hour to get through all of, you know, to find a Band-Aid in Charles de Gaulle. But we managed to make it through. It was just very stressful.
Hey,
But as for the Pro Tour itself, I don't have, you know, super vivid memories, but there were obviously like talk of Cobblade, you know, spread through the room, and you know, Cobb Go had already been a thing, as I mentioned earlier, from Kibler at Worlds, which was basically Cobblade without Stoneforge Mystic. You know, it was more controlling. And then everyone's just like, yeah, Sword of Feast and Famine is busted. And I remember telling people that, like, Sword of Feast and Famine was good when I read it, and I felt vindicated about that. Obviously, like, didn't realize, you know, in Stoneforge Mystic were amazing, didn't, you know, come close to figuring that shit out. But it was cool, like, watching, you know, people play the deck in the feature match area and seeing everybody. But mainly, I just, like, got shat on all weekend and, you know, went home feeling like, yeah, this is a level of Magic that I have not yet reached. Yeah, I started to feel good, you know, with the winning a PTQ, immediately top eight, the first PTQ of the next season. It felt like I got really unlucky to, you know, to lose. And to this day, I will argue that playing the Kitchen Finks is the right play. You know, they probably have like one or two Cascade Bluffs in their deck. Like, the odds of them having it is incredibly low. Whereas, like, if I play, you know, nothing and they just like play a Jace the next turn, then I have to start tapping out and I could like easily lose.
You're supposed to jam.
Yeah, you're supposed to jam. So, as much shit as I got from like all of my friends for jamming. I started to feel like I was really good, and then I just like got shit on at this Pro Tour. I was like, yeah, I probably need to put in some more work.
Yeah, the realization like of the different level of Magic it is when like you stand out at your local level versus when you go to a bigger, real, like, I don't say those events aren't real, a bigger, yeah, more serious event where everyone is at your level or higher, and then you're like, oh boy.
And as impressive as, you know, the Cobblade deck was and all that, the person that actually impressed me most from watching that Pro Tour was Paul Rietzel. He was playing the Boros Landfall aggro deck. And I just remember watching him, and so many times he would play things like very slow, very cagey, and then I would realize why, like two turns later, I was like, oh yeah, now he gets to like play through, like, and he would just like grind through all of his opponent's stuff. Whereas, you know, I was still at the time where I was playing aggro decks really aggressively and, you know, getting blown out, you know, a lot more often. And, you know, this was an aggro deck that had a lot of card advantage and, you know, a high land count could, you know, play well into the middle late game. So, you know, watching him navigate through that tournament, he ended up losing the finals to Ben Stark, was impressive. That's definitely memorable. But yeah, not, you know, the best first showing at a Pro Tour. Though it would be better than my second showing.
I have to remember all that, but yeah, my first showing wasn't super great either. But I mean, like, it happens, right? You know, like, yeah, you're talking about.
Yeah.
It kind of geared you up and got you better.
What were you doing during this time? I feel like I've been talking for like 40 minutes.
You have.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of just like was kind of coming back, and like that's kind of, it actually works out well here because I wasn't playing a ton. And the next set is the set. I mean, we're not gonna talk about this time. We're talking about the next episode because I want to give this set and the set after that their due. Because yeah, not only are both sets great, the next set is my favorite set of all time. And it's my favorite limited set, maybe my favorite constructed set. I loved playing limited in this era, and I fully came back to Magic at this point. Like, I started traveling, I started going to like SCG Opens and stuff quite a bit. And by traveling, I mean, I went to the ones that were drivable. So I'd go to like Atlanta, there was like one in Tennessee that I could go to, and I could go to like Dallas. So I'd go to like 3, 4, 5, 6 a year, you know, depending on if they doubled up.
Those who want a time, so this is 2011. I believe this might be the first year where they branded it the Open Series. They certainly had it branded in 2012. They might have had it branded in 2010.
Yeah.
So they did an Invitational in 2010. I believe that was the first Invitational. It was the one that Bert and Cheney won, and he got a full set of power, and then he got banned like 2 weeks later.
Yeah, they tried to get it back.
Yeah, there was a whole to do about it, whether they legally still like were obliged to give him the power. And then the next year they ran two Invitationals. They had one in the summer at the 6 month mark, and then one at the end of the year. That was 2011. The first year they had two Invitationals. 2012 they expanded to four. That was my first year grinding a bunch of SCGs. I played some in like 2009, 2010.
I started playing them around this time. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm in the same boat as you. I've still got several good stories before Innistrad. Do you want me to just do those? This will be a me heavy episode, and you can.
I actually like. Yeah, I mean, you can do like, can you do them relatively quickly? I've got to run out of time.
So the next big finish that I have is actually Legacy. This is when the first time I played Legacy Elves. So that May, right after this was going to be like release weekend for New Phyrexia, or very shortly after that, there was a Legacy Grand Prix in Providence. So local Grand Prix, we're obviously going to go. I had like gotten into Legacy a bit. So I used to play a bunch of vintage with my friends, like local vintage events in the mid-2000s. And while I was away at college, they started getting into Legacy. This is when Legacy is starting to get popular. And there's a bunch of Legacy events in New England that they're starting to play. I actually, one winter on when I was home, I played a Legacy event. And I'd been borrowing Burn / Tarmogoyf to play Legacy from them, because I obviously had to like borrow a deck. And I was getting tired of that deck. It was bad. And so I like browsed through the source to find a cool deck that I could play. And I ended up playing Dragon Stompy, which is like the precursor to Mono Red Prison with just way worse cards. But it still got to play Chalice and Blood Moon and like Ancient Tomb. And I won that. And I like won some Mox Diamonds. So I started playing a bunch of Mox Diamond decks in Legacy for a while, because I owned 4 Mox Diamonds from that tournament. But for this Grand Prix, like the Mox Diamond decks weren't good. And I decided, like, you know, I was going to find a deck that I thought was good and, you know, borrow it early, like, get it in, because I'm going to have to borrow cards, and, like, get some practice in with it. You're right. And I landed on Elves from an article that Matt Sperling wrote on Channel Fireball. And I was like, this deck looks good. And I remember, obviously, Elves from, you know, Extended and how good it was in Berlin. I was like, I think this deck might be good. And I start playing with it, and I initially played it without Cradles. I was like, Cradles are expensive. I don't want to borrow them. And I was reading through the source, which was this forum devoted to Legacy. It's probably still up. And and everybody there is like telling me I don't need Cradles. They were wrong. Holy shit. And so I try without. And there was a series of monthly events in upstate New York run by Jupiter Games. And that was my big testing ground. I went to one of them in March. And I went 3-4, and my deck felt bad. I was like, maybe I need to pick a different deck. But I was like, okay, before I do that, I'm going to try it with Cradle and see. And if it's not good then I'll pick a different deck. And so I tried it with Gaia's Cradle and was like, holy shit, am I an idiot? This card is a bust. And I started winning a bunch in my testing. And then I went to the next month's Jupiter Games event, and I split the finals. And this was like my last tune-up before the Grand Prix. I split the finals with the guy who ended up winning the Grand Prix, James Rankiewicz. Fun fact. And so I'm feeling good. And then Mental Misstep gets previewed. And I'm just like, you got to be fucking kidding me. Like,
yeah.
How often do you get cards that like reshape Legacy in a set? So I figured like, you know.
Well, we're about to in the very next set, by the way.
Yeah.
What did you know?
So, of course, like Mental Misstep gets previewed. And I'm just like, Jesus, I think my deck might be like unplayable. And I'm worried. And at the time, the decks that I was most worried about were the Sensei's Top Counterbalance control decks. And so I built a version of it with Mental Misstep. It also had like main deck Humility. Like, this is like, you know, it was miracles with everything but Terminus, because Terminus hadn't been printed yet. But like, as hateful as you could imagine, like, I built this deck as, you know, a testing point. And I gave it to my friend Justin one night, and we played, you know, 10, I think it was 10 games. And I went 5-5. And like, just grinding through Mental Misstep didn't feel like that big of a problem. And I was like, I don't think this is that big of a deal. And ended up being a huge boon, because it pushed all the combo decks out of the format, which was great. So I settle up with Elves. My sideboard plan for decks with sweepers, because this is pre-Deathrite Shaman, so a bunch of people have Parishes in their board. My sideboard plan for them was Buried Alive and Vengevine. All right, it worked really well. And I am crushing this Grand Prix. To this day, I've never been to a tournament where I felt like my deck was that far better than the field. Well, okay. I guess similar to when I played Broken Dredge in Modern and won in Syracuse and Phoenix in Baltimore. But it, like, those are the three. Like, my deck felt that good. Right.
You feel like you're playing a different format. Yeah, I've been there a few times. Yeah. Yeah.
Part of it was people just had no idea how to play against my deck.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the extended version of the deck that everybody knew from PT Berlin that LSV won with, everybody talked about Heritage Druid and Nettlesend, because those were like the new cards that had been printed. That's what like made the deck busted, along with Glimpse of Nature. So everyone was focused on stopping those three cards. Like, we got to stop Nettlesend, Heritage Druid, and Glimpse of Nature. And then I just won every game with Elvish Visionary Wire with Symbiote. Just every single game, and Gaia's Cradle. And I just crushed it through people. Because I was splashing black for Buried Alive Vengevine and also Cabal Therapy for combo decks, I wasn't splashing white, so I didn't have Mirror Entity, which was a common kill at the time. So I was playing an Emrakul in my main deck. It's like a way to kill people. And I just had it in my opening hand against Show and Tell. It was great. Like, I'm running hot. I think I won like 11 die rolls that weekend. Everything's going gangbusters. I ate one day one. I lost to another combo deck that I played. Beat the one where I just naturally do the Emrakul. And day two, I start out with, I think, two wins. So I'm X1, you know, feeling great. I play against Peavy. And he was playing this, like, Sultai control deck with four main deck Pernicious Deed. And I'm just like, oof, this might be tough. But I win game one, like, pretty easily. I just, like, have a fast combo, and he doesn't have a Force of Will, so his, like, Pernicious Deeds don't do anything, because I just kill them all in one turn. And so I'm, like, feeling pretty good, because I've got, you know, the Buried Alive Vengevine plan. PV knew about it, because obviously, like, you know, people find out about things. So I'm sitting there thinking, like, am I supposed to bring in Cabal Therapies, too, because he's, like, a control deck? But then I'm bringing out too much stuff, and I, like, tried to figure it out. I did it pretty clumsily. And so I'd over-sideboarded in game two. He had an early Leyline of the Void. That was his graveyard hate, and he won. And then the same thing sort of happens in game three, where but he didn't have the Leyline, but I just only had two creatures, so I couldn't trigger the Vengevines. So I lose to PB. I win a couple more matches. I remember, like, beating Burn, and my opponent was, like, really surprised I, like, beat, and it was pre-Eidolon, so I don't know exactly what they had, but it was probably Pyrostatic Pillar. But I managed to, like, find my way through a Pyrostatic Pillar before I found an answer. But I get to the last round, and I'm X2. Every table but one at the X2s can draw. This is, like, an 1,100-person Grand Prix. This is before Grand Prix got super big. I, of course, am at the table that can't draw with horrible breakers. Unlucky. So I'm like, okay, whatever. Like, let's play. Well, we got, like, a text feature match. That was fun. It's, like, the first time I got one of those. And my opponent clowns me in about six turns because they were playing a combo deck. it was the Hive Mind combo deck that also got to play Force of Will and Mental Misstep, like your nightmare matchup. That deck ended up emerging that weekend and becoming a major player at SCG events over the summer. So I lost playing for top eight of this Grand Prix, but I still was in the top 16, which back then meant you queued for another Pro Tour. It also raised my rating high enough that I qualified for Nationals for the first time. So I got to play Nationals that summer. I went there with, I had a couple friends that would always go to Gen Con. I don't know if they still do, but at that point, they went every year. So I stayed with them. This Nationals was at Gen Con. I got, you know, got the free badge. That was fun. But I'm super focused. Like, I don't care about Gen Con. I'm here to, like, you know, win me some Nationals. This was post Cawblade banning standard and limited, but it was the core set from the summer. And I didn't really know what to play. I didn't like any of the decks. And so I went there just, like, with my entire collection. I could, like, build almost anything. And I, you know, wasn't sure what I was going to play. The day before, we catch wind that CFB is playing this, like, secret tech deck that is Twin Blade. Cawblade and Twin combined. They were not. I don't know where this information came from, but I believed it. And the person who gave me this information had a list. I don't know where the list came from, but let me tell you, it was sweet. This deck had Trinket Mage, so I was sold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're a simple man.
Yeah. You either you could Trinket Mage for the Lifelink Death Touch equipment or an Everflowing Chalice to get mana. And you have, like, three Trinket Mages and two targets. The rest of the deck was just, like, you know, twin cards in a Cawblade deck. Which honestly, like, wasn't that bad. If I had cut the five card Trinket Mage package for five more Interactor spells, I think my deck actually would have been quite good. Because the actual best performing deck was straight Splinter Twin. Because you got to play, like, Probe, Preordain, Ponder, like, Mana Leak, Mental Misstep, Spell Pierce to protect it. The Shrine of Piercing Vision was basically fucking Demonic Tutor. The Twin deck in that standard summer was unbelievably powerful. That's what I was playing after that tournament. But this was, like, the weekend people started playing just straight Cawblade, but without Stoneforge Mystic, which was more of, like, an aggro deck. or like mid-range aggro deck. That's what CFP was actually playing. And it was quite good that weekend. But I was playing my shitty Trinket Mage, you know, deck. I thought I like got the in and had the like the tech deck. I did not. But I ran pretty hot, and I think a 3-1 to day one. It was 7 rounds each day, and you got to you did 4 rounds of constructed, then a draft, and then day two you did a draft and then 4 rounds of constructed. So I think I went 3-1, and then I 3-0'd the draft. I was quite good at M12 limited, which was super aggressive. And so I'm feeling good. I'm 6-1. I drafted at table one on the next day. I started 0-2. I won the last round of that draft against Todd Anderson. Suck it, Todd. And then I 2-2'd the second portion, realizing I knew at this point that my deck was bad. And I was basically only winning by jamming the twin combo as often as possible and just crossing my fingers. Because I just like couldn't win an interactive, you know, any interactive games. And I went 2-2, finished X5, which was just out of money. You paid to top 32, and X4 basically got you into top 32. So I got nothing. But I felt okay. That was the only Nationals I ever played. They got rid of Nationals after that. And I'm trying to think if I have any other stories from that era. I did play Twin at a Grand Prix. I started 0-2 and then X0'd to make day 2. That was fun. But this is like, you know, my first year started to play more tournaments. I played Twin at like an SCG Open and started like 4-0 and ended up min cashing. You know, I was starting to get into it and actually like, you know, become not bad.
That's me starting with the next set. And yeah. I don't know if I started to be not bad, but I just started playing a lot. So you got some results, but
yeah, better than most.
Yeah. So, again, that's going to be the Innistrad block, followed up by another banger of a block with Return to Ravnica after that as well, which these two sets, very impactful on just every format, pretty much.
I'll save my last story for when we start next one, which is the story of the first Modern Pro Tour Philly.
Sure, I remember this. Yeah, this is what yeah. I, again,
so this I was is like the Pro Tour I queued for via yeah. Elves.
This is the Skins Pro Tour, right?
No, that's previous Pro Tour Philly in sure. like 2005. That was extended.
No, because I thought the first Modern one was Skins.
It was not.
Okay.
They
I
were
believe
both
you.
Philly Pro Tours. The Skins Pro Tour was also in Philadelphia, but it was in like 2005. For people that don't know what we're talking about, they did one test event where they changed the payout structure for Pro Tours. And it was Skins. So you got a payout for each match you won after the third, I believe.
I don't remember.
I think if you got 3 match wins, you still got nothing. But every match win after the third got you an amount of money. And depending upon what, and it scaled up. Like your 10th match win was worth more than your 5th. So the deeper, and as soon as you got 3 losses, you were out. So it was triple elimination, and that was just the Pro Tour, and they just did that till they got to 8 people.
It was also massively flawed too, in a lot of ways. Like there were people that had better records than other people. I mean, worse records than other people made more money, etc.
Yeah, it was weird. They only tried it once. They immediately reverted it. Yeah. Same with Magic Weekend. Magic Weekend at Paris, by the way, was kind of a clusterfuck. The GP and the Pro Tour were in completely different rooms, so it felt like 2 separate events.
Yep.
Basically. The GP was also like 2,200 people. They had to divide it into 3, which was everything was a giant clusterfuck. This is like right when GPs are starting to get really big, you know, hitting over 2,000 and consistently hitting 1,000.
People are starting to really travel for Magic now.
Yeah, exactly. Everything's starting to get big. We're starting to get into it, you know, and we're starting to not suck so much.
There we go.
Yeah, that's where we are.
Yeah, I guess that's going to be, I would assume, next week's episode, if we're getting spoilers here really soon as well. Plus, I'll probably have a lot to talk about after the Hunter Burton Memorial Open this weekend as well. Going to get exposed to Modern for the first time with no Violent Outburst. So we'll see what happens if somebody comes up with something, or if it's just going to be a lot of the same old, which is more of what I expect.
Yeah. Oh, it's definitely going to be more same old, same old. The real question is, you know, is Rhino still going to be really good? Is it just going to be Titan and Yawgmoth? You know, people have been speculating
we'll
that.
Esper Reanimator has been making some waves.
Yeah, I've heard really good things about that deck. There are people that think that like that was already the best deck even before the ban. We just haven't figured it out yet. Or like there hadn't been a tournament to shine a light on it yet. Hopefully that deck is really busted and shines enough of a light on fucking Grief that we finally get that card out of here. think it was really funny.
It might happen when MH3 starts happening, so we'll see.
I do think it's funny that everyone chicken littled about grief during the preview season, and then it was like thought as bad for a long time, and then like a year and a half later, it's just like, actually, no, it was busted.
Yeah, we were all right.
Exactly. We were right the entire time.
They were all right. They were right. We were dumb, et cetera, et cetera. Thanks for listening to this episode of MCU Rants as we go down memory lane and got to cover a little bit of the news that had happened. I'll assume that the next episode is going to be another flashback, maybe just because we don't have a lot going on right now this time of year, but we'll see. We'll see what happens.
I'm sure you're going to have a lot to talk about with Innistrad. We can also talk about Planeswalker points.
There's a lot to talk about during this I go hard for a little while.
We'll start with ProTor Philadelphia and my story from that, and that does segue into Innistrad, because we got some previews for Innistrad. That was the weekend we found out that they were going to have double face cards
for the first time.
We started going nuts about it. It was also when we found out they were going to bring back team events. That all happened the weekend of that Pro Tour. It was also the first time I tested with other people for a Pro Tour. That was fun. I met Matthias Hunt that weekend. I met Jarvis Yu that weekend. He got really mad at me because I was kind of a dick to him. So that's fun.
I don't know. I said good.
Yeah. And it was also one of the worst Magic weekends I've ever had in my life. So that'll be a fun... Philadelphia is a fun story.
Innistrad, my favorite limited set of all time. One of my favorite cards of all time is printed in the set. You know, Delaware Secrets, if anybody who isn't sure of what I'm talking about. But we'll get to that in the next episode. Again, thanks for listening to this episode. We love each and every one of you. But until the next one, thanks for listening.